A new book, Beyond the European Social Model, has been published by Open Europe, a London-based think tank. With chapters from a variety of authors, it says that the European social model has failed. Instead, Europe should look to Ireland, the Celtic tiger, which in 30 years has moved from the sick man of Europe to the second richest European economy. I'm here with Open Europe's director, Neil O'Brien. Neil, it's widely recognised that the European social model in France and Germany hasn't worked. People write about that every week. But in fact, as your book says, there are two types of social model. Could the version followed by Sweden and other Nordic countries provide the economic prosperity that we Brits so like, but also combining it with better social outcomes?
Well, I think there are really kind of two things going on here. One is that there is a distinction that people increasingly make between the kind of core European social model of France and Germany and the Scandinavian model, which is much more fashionable at the moment, because people believe that that's a way of combining, you know, economic dynamism in good and knowledge economy with having a kind of fair society. And there is a kind of second issue as well, which is that you still quite often in Europe hear this argument that although Europe isn't doing that well economically in terms of, you know, GDP numbers, well, compared to the US, it's still a social success, it's a fairer society and doing better in that sense. Quite often those two arguments are run together. So in this book, pulled together by a large group of very interesting kind of young think tank people from across Europe, we have a look at some of these different questions from lots of different angles. And one of the things we found is that although there is this enormous amount of what I would describe as hype, really, about the kind of Scandinavian social model at the moment, actually, if you scratch the surface, things aren't quite as good as they might initially appear. Because obviously it's very difficult for people who are fans of the European social model and big, kind of big government spending at the moment to say, like they used to back at the start of the 90s, that France and Germany are the way of the future, is all going really well. That's why there is now this interest in saying that Scandinavia is the way of the future. And so you had people like Douglas Alexander, the Britain's Europe Minister, making that point the other day. People like Polly Toynbee on The Guardian in Britain make this point a lot. Because of course, you know, you've got students writing about a CPA in France, you've got doctors in Germany on strike, you've got Italy's economy going down the Swanee pretty quickly. Inevitably, people are looking for something they can hold up as a model that works. But actually, if you look at the detail of what's going on in Scandinavia, if you take Sweden, it's not as good as you might hope. Not only is it not doing that well economically, really relatively. For example, back in 1975, Sweden was the fourth richest country in the world. Now it's the 22nd richest country in the world. Ireland, back in the day, used to be the 22nd richest country in the world. Now it's the fourth richest. They've effectively swapped places. And so, really not doing as well in macroeconomic terms as you might hope, but also not really doing that well socially. And this is a really interesting thing, I thought, because we dug up some data on incomes for the poorest people in different European countries. It's quite hard to find the data. But we found that over the last decade, the incomes of the poorest 10% of people have grown 8 times faster in Ireland than they have in Sweden, and about 6 times faster in Britain. So you start to wonder whether people talk about this social model, but if you're not really generating rising incomes for the poorest people, and if you have high unemployment, really is this a social model at all?
In 2004, of course, EU leaders signed up to a Lisbon agenda, the idea of making the EU the most competitive and dynamic knowledge-based economy in the world by 2010. Do you think that's a likely outcome?
Europe's not in any way on target to meet those targets set down in the Lisbon agenda in 2000. The employment targets aren't going to be met. The idea that Europe would be the most competitive economy in the world is, I'm afraid, is a joke at the moment. So no, it's not working. And I think one of the reasons it's not working is because, in a sense, the whole Lisbon thing is slightly misconceived, because it's based on the idea that it's somehow the responsibility of the European Union or cooperation in the European Union to try and turn around the European economy. And really only the member states can do that. So what I think we need now is to take a step back and say, well, actually, let's have a clear division of responsibility here. The EU needs to sort out the things that it's responsible for, like, you know, reducing trade barriers or reducing the level of regulation that the EU itself has imposed over the last 20 years. Whereas it's the member states that really have to take a plunge and go for the kind of radical economic change that countries like Ireland have already done.
But of course, Tony Blair argues that the EU needs to reform its budget and get rid of agricultural spending in order that the EU itself can spend more on technology. Do you think that's the way forward for EU reform?
I think it's certainly, Tony Blair's certainly right in saying we need to phase out the CAP, which is just grotesque in every way you can imagine. Not just because it raises the price of food and clothes for the poorest people in Europe, but also, you know, as everyone knows, it's hugely damaging to the rest of the world and developing countries. But the idea that you then take that money and spend it centrally through the EU, I've got to say I'm sceptical about. I think it would certainly be a good use of the money to spend it on research and development, but I suspect that the member states are in a better position to do that than the EU is. And to some extent, really, you know, if we want to be world leaders in science and technology, this isn't about how much the government spends. There's a very interesting chapter in our new book written by a guy from Estonia called Mithis Kitsin, who's a sort of technology expert. And he's pointing out that government spending on R&D, it doesn't actually do that much for your economy. If you want to build a knowledge economy, actually what you want to do is first build a successful economy in general. So he has some rather good examples about Estonia. He tells a story in particular of the company Skype, which is a company which sort of revolutionized telecoms by giving you free internet-based phone calls. And that was interestingly set up by two guys from Denmark and Sweden who left there because taxes are high and went to Estonia. Like, obviously taxes are a lot lower, there's a very low level of regulation. And I just think the whole idea that the government is the answer to the problem of kind of getting into the knowledge economy is probably misconceived. Silicon Valley is not where it is because of some government project. It's there because people, individuals, companies just made it happen.
Well, of course, Jacques Chirac says that compared with Britain, France is better because it pays a higher percentage of its national wealth into education and science. But of course, its economy doesn't seem to be growing very well.
Yeah, I mean, there are things which are the responsibility of government, like helping sort of people get access to higher education that wouldn't otherwise be able to afford it. But again, you just need to be careful about what's the responsibility of who. And I think that using all these kind of input-driven measures about how much you spend on government-financed R&D aren't really the things you should be looking at, because not only is there a question about looking at outputs rather than inputs, there's also a question about the sheer amount of spending on R&D doesn't actually tell you that much about how useful the R&D is. I mean, it could be military research and development that doesn't really do much for the rest of the economy, or it could be, like in the Estonian case, rather kind of marginal technological changes where you take existing ideas and you combine them in new and interesting ways, like in the case of Skype that I just mentioned, and then you don't have to spend a lot of money, but you're producing a huge kind of technological revolution, which is really kind of powering your economy.
Coming back to the Nordic countries, they do of course seem to have had some technological success. Nokia, for example. But your book argues that that isn't due to the sort of social model that they're following.
No, I think these things in a sense can happen anywhere. It's not because of the Scandinavian welfare state that they have Nokia and Ericsson. And in fact, I mean, if you want to look at the origins of those companies in the 90s, really that was all about the way that Scandinavia got hammered by the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, which quite interestingly prompted a whole wave of reforms, quite liberal reforms in those countries, and also prompted companies like Nokia and Ericsson to restructure, dump their old industries and focus on the industries of the future. Actually, there's several of the articles in this book point out that it's quite an interesting question about, we talk about, you know, the Swedish social model as if it's a real thing, but actually there are a lot of signs of change there. I mean, the kind of education reforms in Sweden, which have introduced kind of basically a lot of market forces into secondary education. You know, I can't imagine any UK politician advocating them because they're so radical, but the Swedes have gone ahead and done it. So maybe we need to be a bit careful about just sort of assuming that we understand what all these companies' so-called social models look like are.
And final question, what do you think the future of EU reform will be like? Where do you think we'll be going in the next 10 years?
Well, I think that the answer is to try and kill all of the birds with one stone, really. At the moment, you have a situation where some of the member states want deeper integration. That's why you have this constant chorus of calls to bring back the EU constitution. And then you have other member states that basically want less integration, like Britain and I'd argue the Netherlands. I mean, in some ways, the Netherlands is a more Eurosceptic country than Britain, as you saw from their referendum result. And at the same time, you have a problem where enlargement of the EU is really completely stuck now. Turkey's enlargement is not going to happen because it's never going to get past the referendum in France and Austria. So how do you solve all these mutually irreconcilable problems? And I think the answer to that is to come up with a structure for a radically more flexible Europe, what I might call an open Europe, or you might call variable geometry, whatever you want to call it, but something which allows you set up effectively a kind of common core, a narrow kind of Europe light, which that constitutes your membership in the European Union, and then everything else is optional. It lets other countries go ahead and, you know, create a single European defence if that's what they want to do, with us not involved in it. And it lets us extend a lighter version of the EU, which doesn't come with this kind of vast tranche of 90,000 pages of acquis communautaire, to countries like Turkey, to countries like this, to Ukraine, to Georgia, etc., etc. And I really think that that more flexible way is actually the only way forward for Europe, because nothing else is going to work.
Neil O'Brien, thank you very much.